Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Kai Wortmann, working in philosophy of education at the University of Tübingen, and I'm here today with Robin Zelikatis, who holds the chair for social philosophy at the Free University of Berlin. We want to talk about his new book, Critique as Social Practice, Critical Theory and Social Self-Understanding. In this book, Zelikatis focuses on the possibility of social critique without either diagnosing ideological delusions and false consciousness, but also without just following whatever positions the social agents hold themselves. I must confess, I'm really enthusiastic about the book because A, it is a real page-turner. It reads like a crime thriller, at least if you're interested in these kinds of questions. B, it's clearly structured, and C, it is interdisciplinary in the best sense of the word. It tackles a systematic problem by drawing on philosophy, but also heavily on sociology, and also with an eye on methodological issues in anthropology and even psychoanalysis. So I'm really happy to have the author here. Robin, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Before talking about the book, can you maybe start off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you into philosophy and what made you interested in the issue of critique?
Sure. Let me again thank you for the invitation to be on this podcast, and thanks also for your kind words on the book. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I was already interested in philosophical issues in my time in high school. Although neither of my parents or any other member of my family had studied, issues in history, politics, and so on always took my interest, but I was always interested in the more philosophical aspects of them. I was the first in my family to study, so philosophy was certainly not the obvious choice. My parents were quite anxious that this would not be, very wise with regard to my own future. So I studied political science and philosophy, and they said, well, basically, at least you can become a politician or something later. But as I went along, I got more and more interested in the philosophical issues. My real passion was philosophy, so I followed that. I got the chance to do a PhD at some later point after studying in Göttingen and Berlin and New York for some time. And this possibility of doing a PhD in philosophy basically was my ticket into, following an academic career, something I hadn't really envisaged at the beginning of my studies, obviously. So I got interested in issues, especially in political and social philosophy. And I quickly realized that there's a particular paradigm that seemed particularly relevant and intriguing to me, and that was the paradigm of critical theory in the Frankfurt School tradition. And what attracted me to critical theory was its commitment to be more than just an armchair theory, its commitment to contribute to emancipatory social change and to do so on the basis of an analysis of what is wrong in our social reality. So while I was always interested in philosophical issues, also and already in high school, I think I was interested in practical challenges or challenges that I experienced or saw in our social world. And I was really happy to discover that there are philosophical tools we can use to better understand these challenges and to try to address them in a way that contributes to changing society for the better. And, you know, then I wrote my PhD thesis. It turned into the book that we're discussing today. It was originally published in German in 2009, I think. And after finishing my PhD, I held my first permanent position at the University of Amsterdam, where we had a fantastic philosophical community that really allowed me to grow and to, you know, develop my interests in political philosophy and social philosophy. After several stays in the US at Columbia University and in Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study, I then started teaching at the Free University in Berlin, where I currently work, a couple of years ago. And here, together with my colleague Rahil Yegi, who's also a critical theorist, I direct the Center for Humanities and Social Change, which has become a kind of international hub for critical theories. So the issues that I, you know, got interested in during my studies and that I pursued during my PhD and that are discussed in the book are still with me today. Although, of course, I sort of, you know, branched out and developed different interests, but they're all still related to this initial attraction to critical theory as a kind of philosophy that really speaks to social and political challenges and that pursues this emancipatory aim rather than just being, you know, a theoretical enterprise for its own sake.
Okay, great. Maybe we can now turn to the book a little bit. As I said, the book is very well organized and it consists of three major parts describing three models of critique, what you call the model of the break, the model of symmetry, and the model of reconstruction. As far as I can see, the first model of the break is problematic for you. The second model of symmetry offers some solutions for these problems, but again, then you find different problems in that model. So you kind of end up with proposing the third model of reconstruction, and maybe we can just talk us through these three models. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to do so. So maybe it's good to start with the question or the challenge that motivated, you know, my PhD thesis and then the book that came out of it. So I already mentioned that I was attracted to critical theory for this, you know, practical aim that critical theory pursues, namely to contribute to emancipation, to have a practical purpose, as it were. To have an emancipatory aim, so, you know, analyzing the obstacles to struggles for emancipation and trying to expand the possibilities of these struggles. But at the same time, critical theory also is committed to being grounded in practice. It, you know, distinguishes itself, that's already a point that Marx makes, but it comes back in the early writings of the founding generation of the Frankfurt School, especially in Horkheimer's and Adorno's early writings, that critical theory, in contrast to what they call traditional theory, is not only critical with regard to the aim it pursues, it's also critical with regard to its own, you know, it being anchored in practice, it being anchored in social reality. So it's self-reflexive. It's supposed to be self-reflexive. It's supposed to take into account the social and historical conditions of its own theory formation, and it is supposed to be grounded in the social and political struggles and, in a way, the oppositional experiences and forms of consciousness that are articulated in these struggles, struggles to which it then also tries to contribute. So these two aspects of critical theory seemed really important to me, but at the same time, there's also an obvious tension between them, because if you think that, you know, you need critical theory in the first place in order to contribute an emancipatory process that somehow got stuck due to certain structural obstacles, it's unclear whether you can just unproblematically sort of ground that same theory in, you know, the practices, the sorts of consciousness that you find out there in social reality. If they were already sort of fully, you know, operative, you wouldn't need critical theory in the first place. So the challenge, in a way, is to really think about how this dual claim to be based in practice, in struggles, and to aim at practice, at emancipation, how that can be understood. And there is a risk not just of self-misunderstanding on the side of the theorist, so that the critical theorist in the end comes to see her role as being, you know, more independent from the social practices than the initial claim suggests. But there's also a further and more important risk that I, you know, discuss in the first part, especially of ending up with a more, let's say, objectivist or scientistic understanding of the role of the theorist, of the critic, that actually ends up undermining the emancipatory aspiration of theory. So critique itself can have anti-emancipatory effects. That's a claim I basically want to show in the first part, where I engage with, you know, what you rightly recalled, I characterize as the model of the break. So basically a strand of critical theory that sees the need to radically break with the perspective and the self-understanding of the agents, precisely because these agents are subject to ideology, precisely because they are suffering from false consciousness. They don't understand the social mechanisms of domination that they themselves reproduce in the practices they engage in. So they don't know what they're doing, as you know the saying goes, and it takes critical theory to sort of break through this veil of deception, this veil of ideology, and to properly understand the mechanisms of the reproduction of social relations of domination that are secured by these forms of misrecognition and ideology. So that's in a way the starting point, and that's you know what I take the first model to primarily consist in. Now I go into some details there. I show how this model has its source in a way in the founding fathers, as they're sometimes called, of sociology, especially in Emile Durkheim's work. I trace it to a very influential and famous 20th century social theorist and sociologist, Pierre Bourdieu. And I want to show that even someone like Bourdieu, who actually tries to overcome the limits of objectivism in social science, who is committed, you know, who's famous as a practice theorist, even he, in the end, falls into the trap of a kind of orthodox juxtaposition of science and critique on the one hand, and the naive perspective of ordinary agents who are subject to structural forms of misrecognition on the other hand. So there is this kind of epistemological break that really motivates Bourdieu to move, to the Durkheimian side, as it were, to argue for the need for a kind of objectivist understanding of society that doesn't rely on the self-understanding of agents, precisely because these agents are structurally naive, as it were. And they can't really understand the practices they engage in. They can't really understand the conditions under which these practices unfold. And they are forms of consciousness, which Bourdieu calls doxa. Yeah? So it's also recalling the old Platonic distinction between doxa on the one hand, mere opinion, and episteme, or truth, knowledge, on the other hand. That is something that Bourdieu really resurrects in a way and says, well, ordinary agents, they have practical sense. They act like fish in water. They don't really understand what's going on. They just doing what comes naturally would be a formula to describe their way of being immersed in practice. But that doesn't allow for the kind of critical and reflexive distanciation that he thinks the theorist and the sociologist then have to bring in. So he ends up with all these dichotomies that I think are really problematic, and that suggests that there's a kind of structural lack of reflexivity, a structural inability to take up the critical standpoint on the part of ordinary agents. And that's why we need critical social science now, with an objectivist kind of ambition, to break through the veil of practice that shields ordinary agents from really understanding what is going on. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the first part. And I end by suggesting several problems for this model, which I don't think we have to go through here in detail. But there are normative problems. This just doesn't seem to be very respectful of ordinary agents. There are political problems, which I think are actually more relevant, because Bourdieu was also a very engaged critical intellectual who wanted to, you know, support social movements and struggles for emancipation. But it's very hard to see how that can be reconciled with this more objectivist kind of understanding of the role of social science that doesn't really, attribute the kind of critical capacities to agents that they obviously need in order to engage in social struggles that are leading anywhere. So there's a tension here, which I think is problematic. But more importantly, there's a methodological objection. It's simply unclear how the sociologist is, or the critical theorist more generally, is supposed to achieve that kind of objective standpoint that ordinary agents seem to be structurally incapable of achieving. So what kind of knowledge is that? How does the critical theorist access it? And why then is it really not possible for ordinary agents, apparently, to access that standpoint or that knowledge? And finally, I look in detail at what I call the empirical objection, which is basically a historical and sociological, even ethnographic point to a certain extent, where I build on the work of authors such as, importantly, the anthropologist James Scott, who shows that before we say, obviously the agents are subject to ideology because they don't really openly criticize or rebel against the conditions under which they live, we should really look in detail, and we should really look for the maybe not so visible forms of practice, practices of resistance, practices of critique, oppositional forms of consciousness that are existing, that's the empirical point, in almost every context. So this idea that somehow agents are passive victims of the structures of domination, that they are blinded by ideology, that they don't understand what is going on, that they don't resist these forms of domination, that's itself an unwarranted claim on the part of critical theorists. Because if you actually look at social reality, you will find sort of very complex and very heterogeneous forms of critique, forms of critical consciousness, forms of resistance that could provide a starting point for this ambition that I talked about earlier, to ground critical theory in the social practices, in the struggles of its age.
So what struck me was not only this kind of epistemological break between the agents and the critic, but also that Bourdieu seems to claim that in order to emancipate the agents need the knowledge that he, as a sociologist, as the social critic, has. Mm-hmm. And this was really struck me when I recently watched the documentary about him. I don't know whether you know it, Sociology as a Combat Sport.
Yeah,
it's great. And the last scene was so, intriguing to me, because it shows a discussion, as you said, Bourdieu, a great public intellectual, a professor at the Collège de France, so one of the most prestigious academic institution in France. So he joins a discussion in a community center in the banlieue, so a very poor neighborhood, and discusses with a full audience social issues, their situation, their struggles, with great patience and enthusiasm. And he ends this discussion by saying something like, there is this great sociology book, please read it. It was written for you. If you don't read this, you're idiots. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh man, this is so contradictory to his own way of discussing he performed, 3 hours before. So this kind of break was to me not only an epistemological, but also a performative, or a break in power, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting observation. And I think it's important to notice that also my own discussion of Bourdieu, I mean, I'm not trying to say that somehow substantially his work is not useful. I mean, it's extremely important, I think, and he has
absolutely.
He has done a huge service not only to sociology but to society by highlighting and empirically analyzing in incredible detail the mechanisms of the reproduction of social power relations and domination, the relations of domination, also in the symbolic realm. So my critique in a way is a purely methodological one, not necessarily of the content of his theory, which I think also critical theorists and social movements have need to pay attention to. That's extremely important. But there's this tension that you point out, and the scene from the documentary is really striking in this respect. Another example would be this this famous book that he co-authored, The Weight of the World, which is also on the one hand driven by this ambition to give a voice to the affected, to give a voice to the suffering of ordinary people in the world. But Bourdieu, he struggles with this, but he never quite gets to actually giving them that voice, because he always thinks that something has to be added, that they don't really know how to express it, that you need the theorist to be like a mouthpiece, essentially, and a spokesperson for those people, because they themselves can't really articulate their experience in the right way. And I don't want to say that this is necessarily false, but if it's a general attitude, it leads into precisely this kind of anti-emancipatory effect that we discussed earlier, and that also the documentary, I think, exemplifies. And it's interesting, and I refer to that in the book, to see that authors such as Jacques Rancière have early on criticized Bourdieu for that kind of anti-emancipatory effect of his own objectivist stance. I mean, it was very polemical. Basically, Rancière said Bourdieu is a kind of sociologist king, referring to Plato's idea of the philosopher king, the sociologist king who somehow, sees the truth and then wants to guide people out of the cave they are stuck in with their own ideological false consciousness and sort of lead them to the truth. That's a bit of a caricature, but I think from what we discussed, we can also see why it does pinpoint a crucial tension and, to a certain extent, I think a real deficit in Bourdieu's own approach.
So then you turn in the second part of the book to Luc Boltanski and the model of symmetry. And Boltanski was, of course, a student of Bourdieu, who later also got highly critical about his teacher's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically I was looking for alternative approaches that would avoid both the underestimation of agents' reflective and critical capacities, as well as the overestimation of what the sociologist or the critical theorist could bring to the table, as it were. So avoid this dual problem that I think the first model, the model of the break, has, namely, that it sidelines the agents and their actually existing critical capacities and practices of critique and resistance, but it also overburdens the critical theorist with a role that she cannot really fulfill for all these different methodological, etc., reasons that I discuss. And then I sort of turned to a literature that is not that often discussed in social philosophy and in critical theory, namely the early approach elaborated by Harold Garfinkel called ethno-methodology, which has been somehow forgotten, but which was quite influential earlier in the 20th century. But then also more prominent maybe voices from recent social theories, such as Bruno Latour, who basically says his slogan is follow the agents. There's a kind of ethnographic turn. We should not come with our big theoretical concepts, and because these are actually epistemological obstacles, according to Latour, and not the naive conceptions of the agents, but actually the conceptions of the theorists. They are the obstacles. We have to get rid of them. And we should just see what agents do in practice. And Luc Boltanski is the theorist, I think, who developed the most complex and also, I think, the strongest version of that, what I call methodological egalitarianism. Yeah, this idea that we should take agents seriously and that we should start from their practices of critique and of justification. So what Boltanski and some of his co-authors did is to basically replace the asymmetry that, from Durkheim to Bourdieu, a very strong current in social theory was committed to, with what they call a principle of symmetry. The symmetry between the theorist, the sociologist is doing on the one hand, and what the ordinary agents are doing on the other hand. They're basically doing the same, just with maybe different levels of complexity, etc. But there's no difference in quality or no qualitative break between these two. The second thing they introduce is what could be called the principle of pluralism. So in Bourdieu's view, the social world is characterized by a kind of vicious circle of misrecognition and the reproduction of the status quo. So these mutually condition each other, and it's a kind of self-accelerating spiral, right? And for Boltowski, this is a much too unified and much too homogeneous understanding of social reality. What Boltowski wants to highlight is that there's always a plurality of modes of action and of what he calls regimes of justification and critique that agents can refer to, so they can exploit this heterogeneity of the social world for and in their practices of critique. So basically play different forms of justification, different social practices against each other. Third, they reject this idea of ordinary agents as judgmental dopes, to use one term that has been used in criticizing Bourdieu. They replace that with what could be called the principle of reflexivity. So, agents have these reflective capacities, and we should focus on what they are actually capable of doing, not on what they are incapable of doing. And so this, taken together, brings Boltowski to a very rich understanding of the practices of critique that ordinary agents are engaging in, to a very rich understanding of their quite sophisticated reflexive capacities, their ability to distance themselves from their environment, their ability to engage in quite complex discourses of critique that they think complicate the kind of juxtaposition of theory on the one hand and everyday practice, everyday consciousness on the other hand. And I found that extremely attractive. I thought it was a liberating kind of move. It opens up a whole realm of interesting practices to research for critical theorists, because there are a lot of practices of critique and resistance out there that I think critical theorists can study and that can serve as a starting point for their own understanding of society and what goes wrong in it. But there's also a massive problem with this Boltowski approach of the so-called sociology of critique. So basically he says, from critical sociology to a sociology of critique, we should just sociologically describe and analyze the practices of critique that are out there. But there are two problems I think this approach runs into, and Boltowski himself has actually more recently come to see those, and he turned himself to a more critical understanding of the task of sociology in response to, I was in discussing it with him as well. I'm not saying that he responded to my criticism, but it's a conversation, and I think he realized, especially in taking critical theory more seriously, that the sociology of critique might be limited in certain respects. And in my view, there are two limitations. I mean, one is that there is this kind of presumption that actors simply have the capacities and competences that they need in order to engage in the practices of critique that are then being studied. And I think in general, that's a good assumption to make, but it's not one that we can, simply take for granted. And agents, depending on the social conditions under which they live, will be able to very different degrees, to develop these capacities and to exercise them. And the second limitation is that the sociology of critique, and that holds for Garfinkel, for Latour, but also for Boltowski, that they simply assume that there is a plurality of sort of practices of critique that agents can engage in, so that not only the subjective but also the objective conditions of the practice of critique exist and can serve as a starting point for the sociology of critique. But I think that's simply not the case. I mean, as I said, first, there's the possibility of an unequal distribution of and of structural restrictions on the capacities of subjects to distance themselves from their context and to engage in critique. And second, there is the possibility that certain social contexts and power relations immunize themselves from the pressures of justification. They repress practices of critique or, you know, prevent them from developing in the first place. So we cannot simply assume that the capacities and these practices are there, but we have to look at conditions that might systematically, and not just contingently, but for structural reasons, that means restrict the possibilities of critique that are open to agents. So I think, you know, this is something that really then motivates me to look further and to say that, okay, there's an important point that this model of symmetry allows us to see, namely that, you know, there are practices of critique that agents ordinarily have quite sophisticated critical and reflexive capacities. But also, and that's the turn into the third model, we have to look at the social conditions of the development and the exercise of both the capacities and the social practices of critique agents engage in. Critical theory needs to ask which social conditions are necessary for the development and the exercise of these critical capacities, and it cannot avoid the question which social conditions sort of structurally prevent these capacities from being developed and these practices from being engaged in and from being effective as practices of critique.
So I tried to summarize these two last points a bit. So you first you say that there is a kind of subjective element that the actors themselves don't have the capacities or competences to exercise critical practices, or not necessarily have these capacities, or have them not equally distributed. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you say that the social conditions of critical practices, the kind of objective side of critical practices, can simply hinder the actors to really do critique. Is that a kind of correct summary?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I want to say. So it's, you know, it's both about the presuppositions on the side of the subjects. So that's what I mean with subjective. It's not in the sense of it's somehow subjective, but it's on the side of the subject. We have to presuppose certain capacities, and the development and the exercise of those capacities always has social conditions, right? And so that's the first set of conditions that we have to look at. We cannot just stipulate that they exist. And then the second one is indeed that there are practices of critique that subjects with such capacities can engage in, and that these are not sort of completely ineffective, but that they have, you know, that they are situated in a social context in which they potentially at least have an effect as well. And that's the kind of objective condition. I mean, in Bortonsky's vocabulary, I mean, he basically says, as I mentioned, that there's always a plurality of practices of critique and regimes of justification. Yeah? But again, I think this might be true in most circumstances, but that plurality can be very selective, it can be highly restricted, and it can be, in some contexts, maybe even collapsed if, you know, you have a hegemonic regime of justification, or if you have something like ideology, that's precisely a situation in which that plurality of practices of critique and justification that are open to the agents is highly restricted, is streamlined, you know, is homogenized, might not actually be what it appears, etc. And so I, in a way, argue that we need to reintroduce some of the vocabulary that, you know, Bourdieu and other critical theorists who followed the model of asymmetry that they used, you know, even like false consciousness and ideology, we have to reintroduce that vocabulary now on a different basis, sort of after learning our pragmatic or pragmatist lesson from Bortonsky and others. But we need that vocabulary in order to account for these structural restrictions that agents might be under.
So then now the listener might ask, is this then a return to the break, or is this a clever avoidance of the break, or is it a break on a different level?
Yeah, so basically it's not a return to the model of the break, because I think that model really does suffer from the structural problems that I point out in the first part. And I do think that the model of symmetry and the kind of methodological egalitarianism I discuss in the second part holds an extremely important lesson for any critical theory, namely that these practices of critique should be its starting point. And so the third part is really devoted to developing what I would call a non-paternalistic, pragmatist, and dialogical model of critical theory that does take ordinary agents, their critical capacities, and the practices of critique they engage in seriously, but without giving up the emancipatory task and the important critical role that critical theory can and has to play. So I try to show that that critical theory precisely finds its important role in analyzing and criticizing the structural obstacles to both the development and the exercise of these critical capacities, structural obstacles that prevent practices of critique from emerging or from being effective. And it needs to account for the possibility of such structural restrictions that block the development and or the exercise of reflexive capacities of ordinary agents in practices of critique. Such obstacles, I argue, can be understood as what I call second-order pathologies or second-order problems, because they block first-order forms of critique from emerging or from being effective. And that manifests itself in a kind of structural reflexivity deficit, as I argue, on the part of the agent. So in focusing on these deficits or on these blockades or obstacles, my understanding of critical theory can be characterized as a metacritical approach. Metacritique in the sense of it's a critique of critique, but critique now in the sense of the Kantian understanding of critique. Critique as an analysis of the conditions of possibility, but also of the conditions of impossibility of ordinary critique. So it aims at establishing or reestablishing the possibility of everyday practices of critique. That's what critical theory, in my view, is primarily about. It's not so much about a substantial idea of how the good or the just society should look like. Rather, it's about removing the obstacles that keep agents themselves from engaging in practices of critique, from engaging in changing society for the better, from engaging in developing these ideas of the good or the just society. And I try to show how this model can be substantialized following insights articulated both by the young Habermas, when he argues that there's a methodological similarity between psychoanalysis and critical theory, but I also try to show how it can build on the work of W.E.B. Du Bois, who's interested in the kind of effects of structural racism on the psychological capacities, on the consciousness of dominated subjects, but who's also interested in the critical capacities that might result from such domination. Yeah? And I try to show how critical theory can really, in a kind of interdisciplinary and dialogical way, build on the experiences of oppressed people, of oppressed agents, without uncritically following their own standpoint. So it's a relation of tension that results from it, but it's that tension precisely that makes the interaction between critical theory and ordinary agents, between critical theory and social movements, etc., so productive in my view.
So I try to understand the idea of metacritic a little bit in more detail. Would you agree that it is fair to say that on the object level of the agent's criticism, the social critic as an academic has no right to interfere and say, oh no, you're wrong, you're guided by false consciousness, I know it better than you do. But so there you completely follow the model of symmetry, Whereas on the meta level, you kind of follow the model of the break by saying that, of course, the critical capacities and also the social conditions to exercise these critical practices, the agents cannot have a full understanding of, because they are, of course, emerged in the in their social practices. So here you kind of follow the model of the break, right?
That's one way to put it. I mean,
you can also say no, I'm wrong. That's also okay.
I think that's actually it's a useful way to look at it. But maybe I can come at it from a different angle. So I think that actually many of the concepts that critical theory has developed in order to diagnose and criticize these structural obstacles are in a way second order concepts, right? So we can maybe use ideology as an example, but I think the same is true for alienation or reification. So ideology makes it difficult, if not impossible, for agents to recognize their own situation and to assess its effects on themselves and also their own participation in reproducing relations of domination. Now, I think that ideologies are never total. So that's a difference with some of the more orthodox critical theory crowd. So with certain readings of Marx, with, as I read, Bourdieu, but also with some understandings of Adorno and his idea of a totaler Verblendungszusammenhang, of a complete immersion of consciousness in falsity and delusion. I think that's not really the situation. Ideology always operates in a more fragmented way and leaves open the possibility of critical consciousness emerging amongst those who are subject to ideology. So it does affect the possibility of critique, but it never entirely represses it or makes it impossible, I would argue. But it's still a second order phenomenon, because it affects the ability of agents to engage in critique. So ideologies are problematic, not because they are unjust or because they are somehow keeping people from fulfilling their substantial desires or so. That might be the case, but what is really problematic is that they block the first order attempts of people to make sense of their own situation and to respond to it, and to ask the question how, for example, society should be organized themselves. And in that sense, I talk about metacritique. You could also say it's a procedural turn, as it were. The task is not so much to replace a mistaken or distorted view of social reality with one that is correct. Now, that's the kind of Bourdieusian model of the break that I reject. And neither is the idea that we need to develop a kind of substantial vision of how society should be organized. And that's maybe what mainstream political philosophy does when it thinks about what the ideally just society should look like. But rather, the task of critical theory is metacritical in the sense that it aims to make it possible for agents themselves to ask these questions, to collectively look for answers to these questions themselves. And I think that's precisely also what, in his better moments at least, Freud said about psychoanalysis. He said, "My job is not to tell people how to live. My job is to enable them to ask that question and to answer it for themselves in a way that is not restricted by all these constraints that they have internalized." Yeah. Now, of course, you could respond that this form of metacritique in a way is insufficient, that we need a more substantial sense of where to go. But I think that would really be a mistake to think that the theorist or theory is somehow best situated to do that. I think that's essentially a task for everyone, and critical theory can, I think, make its important but also limited contribution to that task in a way by identifying the obstacles that stand in its way. It's not there to legislate how we are to organize society. It's there to identify the structural obstacles that keep people from thinking about these issues and answering these questions themselves. We can maybe illustrate this a bit in more detail when we look at how some classical critical theorists have discussed the issue of the critique of what is sometimes called false needs, yeah, also falsche Bedürfnisse in German, false needs in English. So Herbert Marcuse, who's of course a very famous first generation critical theorist, he thinks that we need a kind of substantial critique of which needs capitalism has produced, and we have to show that these are false because they are, you know, not grounded in human nature. Now, obviously, this does presuppose a pretty substantial understanding of what human nature is that the critical theorist somehow has access to. And the critical theorist's job is then to say to people, look, the needs that you developed are wrong, they are false needs, and here is why. And I think that's really the absolutely wrong model to go about. I think Nancy Fraser in the 80s already has rightly shown that what is much more important is to look at the conditions under which people interpret their own needs, ascribe needs to each other, and can also contest the way in which needs are interpreted and attributed. So it's procedural in the sense in which critical theory has to criticize the blockades and distortions that keep agents from interpreting and articulating their own needs. It's not supposed to be substantial in the sense of telling them how to do it exactly or what needs to develop or regard as their own. So this kind of meta critique, moving to the second level, or this kind of procedural turn is really motivated by an attempt to reduce the risk of a kind of authoritarian or paternalistic tendency in critical theory that is very much alive still today, I think, and which basically has this anti-emancipatory effect of, to put it bluntly, disenfranchising ordinary agents because they are just judgmental dopes and wouldn't know what is in a way good for them. So in that sense, I think how you put it is correct. So there's no break on the level of substantial claims about either society, how it should be organized, or about individuals, their needs, or how they should lead their lives. But there is a potential break, and I will qualify that in a moment, or a potential asymmetry in the ways in which agents are themselves able to engage with these issues. So in the way in which they either developed or exercised their capacities. But that break is also different from the model of the break in the first part, because these asymmetries, they are partial, so they're not total, right? And they are temporary. So let me just say something briefly about both of these points, and then I'm curious what you think of it. So, I mean, they're partial in the sense of we cannot assume that it's always the critical theorist that somehow has, the fuller realization of critical capacities. Very often it's the ordinary agents themselves, and the critical theorist should learn from their practices of critique, right? But in some situations, it's the agent's capacities that are subject to structural restrictions that the critical theorist might help diagnose. So it's partial, and it's not one-sided, as it were, the asymmetry in question. It's also temporary, because in the classical model of the break, there seems to be a structural reason for why agents are not able to make that shift, for why when they are engaged in practice, when they are on the level of everyday consciousness, they cannot make, cannot take up the standpoint of critique. But in the model that I tried to develop, there is no such impossibility, but rather the standpoint of critique and even critical theory as a practice is already one that is embedded in and can only exist in the realm of everyday practices, right? It's a possibility that is built into that realm itself. It's not something that exists only outside of that realm. And in that sense, it's a temporary asymmetry because agents move back and forth, and they can develop and exercise these capacities. Sometimes with the help of critical theory, sometimes they are able to help themselves. And social movements play an important role here, forms of consciousness raising, etc., that might be inspired by critical theory, but that are still distinct from it. So all these. There is no break, in other words, right? There are temporary and partial asymmetries, and these are important to keep in mind because that's where critical theory as theory also plays a role and a critical role, but it's not having this kind of exclusive monopolistic claim on critique as it has in the first model.
So my final substantial question is, as I said, I'm doing a philosophy of education and working also in an education department. And there often the question is, of course, for example, if you want to be critical about schools, right? And if I now apply your model of distinguishing the levels of critique between on object level and then the meta level, the question arises for me really, how can I know on which level I should operate? Or to put it more concretely, when can I follow the actors? When can I trust them then that they know what they are talking about? And when can I say, well, I as a critical researcher, I know that now in your criticism, there is the issue that you either don't have the full capacity or the social condition is not right that you can really engage in the critical exercise. How can I know on which level I should operate?
So, I mean, my view is that there's no general answer to that. It's part of the, also to a certain extent, experimental and necessarily pragmatist nature of critical theory that you do have to start in medias res, as it were, right? And you have to start with, I would say, the practices of critique, the oppositional forms of consciousness, and the critical capacities that are already, out there that agents have and that they are engaged in. And, I think that this, what Raymond Geuss called the critical theorist's nightmare, the situation in which society is completely integrated and everyone is so much under the spell of ideology that there are no practices of critique, that there are no forms of critical consciousness, that's a very unlikely and historically basically non-existent scenario. So there's always, in other words, a starting point that critical theory can start from. And then it depends on the concrete situation, whether you think that, what exactly the role is that critical theory needs to play. I mean, one of the problems that I think my own discussion in the chapter at the end still suffers from, that this seems to operate with a rather strict still dichotomy or distinction between the critical theorist who's sort of free floating and waits for social agents to get in touch and to see whether he can somehow help them, and on the other hand, sort of ordinary agents or social movements maybe who engage in their own practices of critique. But that is actually a misunderstanding, or that's not how I envision the situation. You know, I think that in a certain sense, ordinary agents themselves can be seen as critical theorists, especially if they engage in very complex practices of critique, for example, in the context of social movements. Theories obviously circulate, so certain theories come to inform actually existing social practices ordinary agents engage in, and the way in which the vocabulary of psychoanalysis, Marxist theory, even Bourdieu's theory has been circulating in society would be an example for that. And at the same time, critical theorists are not just theorists or academics, but they're very often organic intellectuals, one could say, that do not necessarily have to be academics even, but that engage in their work often against the background of movements they are part of. And in this respect, I think we can also learn a lot from feminism and critical race theory, where a lot of the theorists in these fields of philosophy and of theory are themselves very much members of the movements that they then also try to contribute to with their theory. So we shouldn't think of this as a kind of dichotomistic relationship. But most importantly, I think, and that's also something that one can learn both from, for example, Black feminist theorizing that I didn't yet take into account when I wrote the book in the late 2000s, but that I'm sort of more interested in, became more interested in recent years. You know, Black feminists like Patricia Hill Collins have shown that it's a problematic prejudice on behalf of some critical theorists to think that those who are subject to domination don't engage in critique, don't develop their own forms of critical consciousness, don't develop their own forms of resistance. It's a point that Foucault also makes in a certain sense, right? Where there's power, there's also resistance. And I think we have to start from there. Now, how to apply that to the school and to the educational setting that you have been talking about is a different question, one I'm not entirely sure I'm qualified to answer. But I would think, and that's maybe my own experience as you know, a high school student with teachers, but also maybe as a teacher now at the university, that and it's a point that Rancière also makes, right, in his own writing on education, that you will never really get to realize the emancipatory potential of knowledge when you start from the assumption that those you teach don't know anything, or that they are not really capable of you know, critical consciousness on their own, that they need you to basically lift them up, that they need you to lead them to the truth, out of the cave, as it were, in the Platonic metaphor, then you will actually really prevent any kind of development of critical knowledge and critical consciousness. So what you need is to a certain extent, also in those settings, I think, start from the methodological egalitarianism, start from the assumption that agents, you know, students in this particular case are already capable of these forms of reflection, and understand the teaching situation also as one that is necessarily dialogical. I mean, of course, this will also involve temporary asymmetries. I mean, there are certain things that the teacher, precisely because of the training she has gone through, of the time she can invest in, you know, preparing, etc., knows that the students don't know. Otherwise, you know, why would they be there to a certain extent? But that is never a kind of total asymmetry or a complete inequality. It rather presupposes symmetry and equality on all kinds of levels, and also the realization that in many respects it's the students from whom the teachers also have to learn. So I think the complexity of the situation between the critical theorist and the addressees or ordinary agents or however you want to call them, and the complexity of the relation between a teacher and a student might be similar in this respect. Yeah? Although I would hesitate to, you know, compare the critical theorist to a teacher precisely in order to avoid these problematic implications of, you know, let's say the kind of pedagogical vision of critical theory. I don't think that's how we should think about it. But on the other hand, I do think that my pragmatist, dialogical, non-paternalistic understanding of critical theory might have maybe interesting implications for how to think about the teacher-student relation as well. And I mean, you're familiar with Rancière's work, of course, and you know that he saw a kind of close connection between rejecting a certain Platonic understanding of philosophy and of the knowledge that informs critical theory on the one hand, and on the other hand, rejecting a certain understanding of the teacher as the one who puts knowledge into the students that are just, you know, the kind of empty addressees that don't know anything yet and that are waiting to be turned into the right direction. So that's the picture to avoid, I guess, both in critical theory and in pedagogy.
I could talk a lot more about this, yeah. But we've taken up a lot of your time already. My last question is, what are you currently working on, Robin?
Yeah, so I mean, as I said, this book has been originally published in German in 2009 already, so a lot of time has passed. I'm still obviously interested in questions of critical theory, and I spend a lot of time thinking about different practices of critique and of resistance. In the book, I primarily address the kind of obstacles that keep agents from developing and exercising critical capacities. I became more interested also in what happens once they engage in practices of resistance, such as civil disobedience, social movements, etc., and what obstacles these practices then run into. So I worked quite a lot on civil disobedience and other practices of resistance, and I try to come to a kind of radically democratic, again, non-paternalistic understanding of the role of these practices in our very imperfect democracies, and also move a bit beyond the philosophical discussion of these practices that is, again, often quite uninformed, let's say, by the actual reality of these practices on the ground. So again, I try to learn from people who are actually engaged in disobedience and social movements and see what we can learn for critical theory of political protest from them. And so that's a book I'm writing at the moment. It's tentatively entitled Democratizing Disobedience Towards a Critical Theory of Political Protest. And while there is a clear connection with the earlier book, I think it really turns to a quite different sense of practices of critique, namely one that has a primarily political reality in social movements and their forms of resistance. But I'm also interested in the kind of ideologies and other structural obstacles that then prevent social movements from really unfolding their emancipatory potential. So I see a role for critical theory here as well. I also became more and more interested in issues of migration and also racism in our societies, partly due to my own personal background. I'm German-Turkish, and as you can imagine, this from early on has also played a role in how I experience social reality and the many problems of also racism that German society is facing, although Germany for a long time has tended to discuss or see racism only in other places, in the US and maybe in South Africa, etc. But it has become a quite hot topic in public debates. There's a lot of anti-racist organizing, which I think is very inspiring, and I'm very interested in how we should, from a critical theory perspective, address structural forms of racism and their own ways in which they inhibit practices of critique and the exercise of critical capacities in the German and the European context, right? I mean, I think there's a lot to learn from the critical philosophy of race and racism from the US, but it's also clear that the historical, social, cultural, etc. context in Germany and in Europe maybe is quite different. So I'm working with other people together on how to think about racism, migration, anti-migration sentiments and activism in German society, and what kinds of solidarity we could oppose to them, not just on a theoretical level, but as a kind of practical form of anti-racist organizing and critical theorizing. So these are a couple of the issues I'm interested in. There's a lot more, but I won't go into the details. And I just want to thank you for this really fascinating, for your great questions and for the ability to talk about the book. And I mean, as you said, there's a lot more to talk about. I would like to hear your other questions, but probably we're already at the end of the time we can use for this.
So huge questions left, but Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure to be here.